already. So I think Labour has got a big problem. They're shipping more votes to the left than they are shipping votes to the right, and yet they seem to be far more concerned with reform than they are with the threat from the Greens or indeed your party or indeed the Lib Dems.
Let me ask you one question without giving you a fair amount of time to reply to it. Doesn't this question your whole thesis about parties being better off if they move towards the centre? I mean, wouldn't Labour be better off moving to the left to try to get some of these voters and members back?
Possibly, but you'd have to say that, you know, the voters, the electorate are normally distributed. There are more voters in the middle than on the flanks. So it does make sense to try and pull some of those voters in as well. I mean, it's difficult for parties. You know, they face that dilemma each and every day.
Tim Bale, thank you very much indeed. That is Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University of London, Tim Bale. And that is it for me from this afternoon at The Times at One. My producer was Lizzie Highfield. Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. All the fluffs and errors were mine. And next on Times Radio, it's Jane Garvey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it is 2 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio. And between now and 4 o'clock this afternoon, well, the pressure continues to pile up on Prince Andrew after the Times revealed he hadn't paid rent on his home in 2 decades. I'll talk to one MP demanding he be legally stripped of all his titles. My big interview today after 3:30 is with the award-winning journalist Amy Wallace, who helped Virginia Giuffre write her memoir Nobody's Girl, which is out today. We'll also talk about the economy as borrowing soars, tax rises predicted to follow. And if you love history, listen out for Lucy Worsley very soon. She's got a new initiative to highlight the teachers making a real difference. First, the news at 2, here's Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. There's been an urgent question asked in the House of Commons on the inquiry into grooming gangs following the resignation of 2 survivors from the victims panel. Jess Phillips responded on behalf of the government, saying it would not drag on.
It will be time limited to 3 years to ensure that victims and survivors receive answers swiftly. The inquiry will examine safeguarding systems, accountability and intersections with ethnicity, race and culture, identifying failures and good practice.
The Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philp said these crimes have been covered up because the perpetrators were mostly of Pakistani heritage. The victims said that religious and racial motivations for their abuse were being downplayed. Boris Johnson said he'd felt homicidal at having to scrap schools' exams in 2020 and nearly sacked the then Education Secretary Gavin Williamson. The former Prime Minister was asked at the COVID inquiry about comments made by Jonathan Slater, who worked in the Department of Education, that they were ill-prepared for schools to close completely.
My impression from the stuff I read was that a great deal of thought and care was already going into some of the key questions, but you know, this is what Mr. Slater he says he had no plan ready. I think that is surprising.
The Times has revealed Prince Andrew has not had to pay rent on his Windsor mansion for the last 2 decades, although he has paid £8.5 million in lease and refurbishment costs. There's pressure on him to relinquish his privileges following the publication of Virginia Giuffre's book, in which she claims 3 paid sexual encounters with him, which she denies. Gloria Allred, a lawyer for Jeffrey Epstein victims, says he needs to speak up.
The person who is not speaking is Prince Andrew. He's the one that chooses silence now. And of course, now he's trying to make it seem that he's doing his duty by not being a so-called distraction to the king. What about his duty to the victims?
The king cut Andrew off financially last year. However, questions remain over how he funds his estimated £3 million security bill. 2 more men have been arrested at Wakefield Prison by detectives investigating the death of Ian Watkins 10 days ago. They've been questioned on suspicion of conspiracy to murder the former Lost Prophets singer, who was serving 29 years for child sexual offences. 2 others have already appeared in court accused of his murder. A security guard jailed for plotting to rape and murder Holly Willoughby has lost a challenge to appeal his sentence. Gavin Plum was handed a 16-year term in July last year. And Rishi Sunak is joining the Sunday Times as a columnist. The former Prime Minister will write a weekly column in the business section on business, technology, politics and the economy. Mr Sunak says he's honoured to join the paper in what he calls an era of profound change. And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. It is just Jane Garvey again this afternoon. Fee on the mend. I'm sure she'll be back very, very soon. So thank you very much for being here this afternoon. The WhatsApp, if you want to make contact, is 0333 003 2353. We've got an important guest coming your way after 3:30. It is Amy Wallace. She is an award-winning American journalist and the woman that Virginia Giuffre selected to help her write her memoir, Nobody's Girl. There's been so much publicity about Nobody's Girl. It is actually finally and officially available in the UK today. And Amy Wallace is someone I spent part of the morning talking to. Here she is telling me something about Virginia's life.
When you are a young person, a child, who is introduced to the idea that grown men rape children and they don't pay a price for it, You begin to think, after a while, that's the world. That's how it works.
Well, she doesn't mince her words. I hope that's clear. That's Amy Wallace, the American journalist. She worked for many years for the Los Angeles Times. She's written a couple of other books as well and has written for magazines like The New Yorker. So she's a formidable woman. It's a really important book. And you can hear what it was like to work with Virginia after 3:30 this afternoon, the book Nobody's Girl, which is causing so many ripples and making so many headlines all over the world. Also today, the new prize for history teachers. Do you know somebody who really deserves an inspiring history teaching award? We'll talk to one of the judges, the brilliant Lucy Worsley, will be here this afternoon. President Trump appears to have changed his mind on Ukraine's chances of winning the war against Russia. It's not the first time he's changed his mind on all this. We'll try to find out what exactly is happening. The former Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has been giving evidence to the COVID inquiry about the impact of closing schools and cancelling exams. And in health news, well, you can always get an appointment with our favourite GP, Dr. Rachel Ward. Is it really true that women's healthcare is stuck in the 90s, as alleged by the government's women's health ambassador? That's all between now and 4 o'clock. And as ever, I welcome your involvement. 0333 003 2353. There were lots of messages from you yesterday afternoon about Prince Andrew. Please do keep them coming, because it's quite clear that this is a story that actually matters a great deal to very many of you. A quick look at the most read stories on the Times website today. At number 3, Waitrose axed autistic volunteer after request for paid work. This is about 27-year-old Tom Boyd, who had spent more than 600 hours doing work experience at his local shop in Greater Manchester. The second most read story, Oxford Union president-elect ousted after Charlie Kirk remarks that he had insisted that he won't step down despite losing a vote of confidence. That was called after he appeared to celebrate the death of the right-wing activist. And the most read story on the Times website today, it is Prince Andrew. Prince Andrew hasn't paid rent on the Royal Lodge for 2 decades. That exclusive from the Times shines a spotlight on his finances. We'll discuss that and more in a moment. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription, and you can get one. Just go to thetimes.com/subscribe. Prince Andrew, then, in the headlines, under pressure again after the Times revealed he hasn't been paying rent on that mansion in Windsor for 2 decades. It comes as further allegations were published about him having sex with Epstein victim Virginia Giuffre. This, of course, in Virginia Giuffre's posthumous memoir, and you can learn more about that after 3:30 on this programme this afternoon. The Prince has always denied the allegations, but politicians, including in the SNP, are now calling for him to be formally stripped of all his titles. Seamus Logan is the SNP Member of Parliament for Aberdeenshire North and Moray East. Mr Logan, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Jean.
Tell us then, how widespread across your party, your grouping in Westminster, is the passionate belief that actually he's got to give everything up.
It's unanimous. The entire party group have signed the early day motion, which was tabled yesterday, I believe, and we've been joined by Plaid Cymru as well in supporting that motion. Jane, it's very simple. Prince Andrew may agree not to use these titles, but if I can give you an example, if I was given the freedom of the City of London, I'm entitled to drive my sheep across Westminster Bridge. If I choose not to do that, that's my choice. The issue with his titles are that they are peerages, peerage titles, and he retains them officially unless removed by an Act of Parliament. So whether he chooses to use them or not is beside the point. They should be removed. And that's what our motion is about.
Yeah, I think some people felt that not only was his announcement on Friday pompous, that is his normal style, I think. I don't think he knows any other form of communication, really. But also he appeared to be doing this himself. It was still left to him to make these decisions. What do you feel about that?
Well, that's the point. I'm not going to get into any personal insults or attacks on Prince Andrew, although there are many reasons why I might do so, but I'm not going to. This is what I've already laid out, Jane. He retains those titles whether he chooses to use them or not, unless Parliament steps in and removes them. Now, it beggars belief that the Labour Party, the government, are sitting on their hands and waving to us saying that it's up to the palace to decide on this. It's not up to the palace. The laws are made for the people in the House of Commons. We're elected for that purpose, and it's up to us to act in this instance.
Yeah, I mean, I think, let's be honest, most of us don't really understand titles, don't really know what honours are, what they mean, what they stand for, who gets them or why, quite honestly. But we all understand Prince, and as I understand it, there's nothing that can remove that from him. So you and I are obliged to keep on calling him Prince Andrew. Why not make an effort to get rid of that? Is that at all possible? Would that be likely?
Well, to be perfectly honest, Jane, I don't know the niceties of that particular title. It seems to me that if you're born into privilege and power, that that's something that's given to you. And it may be that it's up to the king to decide whether that title should be removed. But it's not just his titles. I feel there are also good questions to be asked here, and in fact these questions are being asked by the Metropolitan Police, who are looking into allegations that Prince Andrew asked a member of his close bodyguard to investigate Virginia Giuffre. That in itself is quite an obnoxious action, and it needs to be investigated fully. Personally speaking, I think his entire financial position should be investigated. He was a trade ambassador for the UK. There are allegations that he used that position to feather his own nest. I don't quite understand how he's able to live the lifestyle that he's become accustomed to with no obvious means of income or support. And there's a question lurking in the background. To what extent did his pals like Jeffrey Epstein provide him with financial support?
Yes. You mentioned the possibility of the Metropolitan Police conducting an investigation. They have had opportunities to investigate the allegations against the Prince in the past and have not apparently taken up that opportunity. What do you think about that?
Well, it's kind of one of these, you scratch your head and you wonder why that hasn't happened, because if it was an ordinary person in the street, I'm quite sure the Met would investigate it fully, and so they should. But as I said recently on another programme, I don't think it's too late for Andrew to come clean about everything and provide a full explanation to any other investigations, whether it's by the Met Police or the FBI or whoever, in relation to what he saw, who he knows was involved, and to provide evidence in that regard. The author of the book Nobody's Child has already invited him to do that.
Well, indeed, I have recorded an interview with that woman, Amy Wallace, and people who listen to Times Radio can hear it after 3:30 this afternoon. She does make the point, Mr. Logan, that that is exactly what Andrew could do right now. But she also says that if he were to do so, he'd be the first man to actually do that, which tells you quite a lot about the entitled world these appalling people inhabit.
Well, at the end of the day, I mean, I think the public are aghast and outraged. And I recognise and respect the extent to which the royal family and the monarchy are held in very high esteem by many, many people across these islands. I understand that. But they must understand, and I'm sure the public certainly do, the damage that Andrew is doing to that establishment. And from their own perspective and in their own interests, I think they should take every step and use every measure they can to put pressure on Andrew to do exactly that, to come clean and cooperate with the authorities.
Would a deal of the nature of what Prince Andrew appeared to have with this house, Royal Lodge in Windsor, would it ever be appropriate for someone to pay a so-called peppercorn rent on a seven-bedroomed, 30-roomed mansion on a royal estate, admittedly having already paid a substantial sum, I gather, for renovations there?
Well, it's certainly not appropriate if it involves public money. That, I think that's the point. If this is some sort of private arrangement between the King and Andrew, you know, maybe that's a family matter, none of our business. But the whole point about it is that I think the royal family already receives substantial public funding. And if any of that money is being used to subvent Andrew's tenure in that property, then I think that is a matter of public concern, yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Logan. That's Seamus Logan, the SNP Member of Parliament for Aberdeenshire North and Moray East. Thank you for your messages this afternoon. Let's see. Sue says royal finances continue to be opaque. MJ says, I agree, Prince Andrew's finances need to be properly investigated, starting with who paid for those renovations on the Royal Lodge. I just referenced that. Over £8 million is the sum that's doing the rounds. Harriet says peppercorn rents are not unusual. Harriet, I think it depends on the circles in which you move, to be perfectly honest. But, I mean, I can't be certain about that, by the way. As you may have gathered, I'm no expert. 0333 003 2353. Let's talk about a really important aspect of all this. Virginia Giuffre's book, its allegations about Prince Andrew and Epstein and her accounts of her terrible experiences have been all over the front pages for days. Gemma Sherrington is the chief executive of the charity Refuge, which helps survivors of abuse. Gemma, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Now, I'm afraid it is a sad fact that many people in our society, women and indeed men, have suffered abuse of one sort or another. What is it like for people to perhaps be forced to revisit some of their own experiences because of all this publicity?
I mean, it can be incredibly difficult, I think, both because of the volume of reports that are out there, so the amount of publicity. And of course, the reminders of their own experience that surfaces. And I think far too often, survivors' experiences, particularly women actually, can be ones of being scrutinised, ridiculed, disbelieved. And whilst the instances of abuse are devastatingly common, you know, one in four women in England and Wales will experience domestic abuse in their lifetime, those situations are rarely treated with the seriousness they deserve. So of course, when this is high profile, you know, and everyone's talking about it, it can bring back really, really problematic feelings of trauma, but also having been disbelieved and kind of scrutinised in a way that was really harmful.
It's very clear that Virginia Giuffre herself paid a price for being so public and being, frankly, so courageous. In the end, as listeners will hear after 3:30 this afternoon, she simply felt that she couldn't go on anymore. And she is a name we know. The plain fact is, Gemma, there were many other people, young girls, abused by Epstein, Maxwell and many, many others whose names we will never know. And they are somehow trying to get on with their lives. Is it actually possible to do so?
I mean, it is with the right support, but there is this undeniable link between domestic abuse and suicide, very sadly. And particularly if a victim or a survivor does not get the support that they need and the support that they deserve. You know, more domestic abuse victims in England and Wales will take their own life than those killed by a partner. And so it is really important that people do seek that support they need. I mean, at Refuge, we run the National Domestic Abuse Helpline and would encourage anyone who is struggling at the moment with any kind of feelings that this reporting may be surfacing, please do get in touch. That's a 24/7 service. There's translation services, there's chat, and that's on 0800 200 247. So we'd really urge people to get the support they need, because, you know, without that support, unfortunately, the outcomes can be really devastating.
Now, we know that Prince Andrew denies the allegations against him, but not surprisingly, the emphasis in this country has been on him and on those allegations. And perhaps we too often focus on that element of this saga and don't put enough emphasis on the suffering of the victims. What can we do to change that?
I think it's such an important point. And that platforming of high profile perpetrators is so distressing to victims. And it's really important to talk about the domestic abuse, but centred on the survivor and victim. And too often the perpetrators in this reporting are shielded from accountability. And there's a really important role that media can play holding perpetrators to account and elevating the survivors and victims in the kind of the reporting and the storytelling, and therefore sort of changing the narrative. Anyone that isn't really holding the perpetrator to account in the narrative is sort of complicit to the ongoing abuse. So there's absolutely a critical role that media can play in the way this type of incident is reported.
And Gemma, to the people who say, continue to say, why didn't she leave? Why didn't the likes of Virginia Giuffre and her other anonymous, the other women whose names we don't know, the girls whose names we don't know who suffered, oh, they could have left. Oh, they were being paid. Oh, they were party girls. How do you challenge that? Because people still say and think these things.
Domestic abuse is master manipulation. It's about creating an environment of fear.
Yes, sorry. I mean, sorry to... I understand, Gemma, that your focus at Refuge is on domestic abuse, but what we're talking about in the case of Virginia Giuffre is a different sort of abuse, although I should say yes. She also allegedly suffered abuse at the hands of her own father. But carry on.
Yeah, so and when I say that, I mean, I actually, if we think about the broader context of violence against women and girls, you know, it is about environments of fear and control, and it does not discriminate. So people may think there's a certain type of person that is more susceptible to that type of abuse, but that's not true. When you look at who it can impact anyone. And I think until you're in that situation, it is very hard to judge what you would do. And we see on average, you know, it takes women up to 7 times to leave a perpetrator because there is such an environment of fear and control. And it goes way beyond some of the physical forms of violence or abuse that women may have suffered. It goes right into that sort of controlling, coercive controlling environment that has been created. So, yeah, I think it's absolutely the bedrock of how abuse and violence happens that is there to control people and actually stop them trying to leave.
Gemma, thank you very much. Gemma Sherrington is the chief executive of the charity Refuge. Nigel says, I think this is the first message of this sort I've actually had on Times Radio, but Nigel says, surely we should now be calling time on the monarchy. Through an accident of birth, an entitled family live a life of extraordinary luxury and privilege at taxpayers' expense, benefiting beyond normal measure through use of state assets. We live in a democracy, but the royals live in a world where we aren't even allowed to question some of their behaviour, wills, sources of funding, inheritance, etc. And they represent us around the world. Time for change. So that's Nigel's view. You may profoundly disagree. You're very welcome to get in touch. Next, the historian Lucy Worsley wants to reward the history teachers who make a real difference. She'll be with us in a moment. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Hey, have you heard? Tesco Fruit and Veg for Schools helps kids like me get more of their 5 a day. They're supporting over 500 schools and have already donated over 10.8 million portions of fruit and veg to thousands of children across the country. So there's plenty more juicy oranges, yummy strawberries and crunchy carrots to go around. I can't wait for snack time. Yay! Tesco, every little helps.
Stop. Listen, chicken. The 10 mini fillet bucket, $7.99. 10 succulent mini fillets. Buy, eat, digest. Good, repeat. Get the deal, believe in chicken. KFC. Until 9th of November, subject to availability, participating restaurants only, excludes delivery. Full T's and C's at kfc.co.uk.
Stayshore. What is Stayshore? Stayshore is not just the UK's favourite travel insurance. Stayshore is the confidence that comes with knowing that you're covered by the company with more five-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other provider. A company that welcomes people of all ages with pre-existing medical conditions for single or multiple trips. So Stayshore with Stayshore Travel Insurance. UK's favourite relates to number of five-star Trustpilot reviews, T's and C's and verifications at stayshore.co.uk/reviews.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as Saints, could help. Saints has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. Saints is managed by Baillie Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
So, what was your favourite subject at school? Chances are the answer is probably connected to the individual who taught it, their enthusiasm or lack of it. To celebrate the passionate teachers maintaining Gen Z's interest in the past, the very first Inspiring History Teaching Awards are launched today by Historic Royal Palaces. They're an independent charity which looks after some of the most iconic buildings in the UK. And the winners are going to be announced next year with an award ceremony in June, I think, at the Tower of London.
That's correct.
It's one of my least favourite places, but I know it's important. The historian and broadcaster Lucy Worsley is here. She's leading the national judging panel. I'm sorry, I find the Tower of London very frightening.
Good.
I always have.
That's as it should be.
Okay. Celebrating history teachers. Is it not one of those subjects that's under threat? We keep hearing that people aren't studying English anymore. Is history potentially in the line of fire there? Or is it still something that people feel passionate about?
It may be at university level, but it's alive and well in schools.
Good.
And yeah. I sometimes find people say, should I study history? And the answer is yes, yes and yes. Not just because it's a wonderful thing to do, it enriches the human experience, but also because it's also, if you care about these things, it will also help you get a job. Because the skills you're going to learn about analysis and doing research and making an argument are very portable skills. You can use them in all sorts of professions. They're skills that you probably have yourself.
Probably, but we're not here. If only we were here to focus on my many skills. But sadly, we're not. This is open to teachers at all levels, is it? Whatever sort of school you teach in, whether it's primary, special needs, secondary, everybody.
Yes. You'll notice it's called the Inspiring History Teaching Awards.
Right.
Because it may be that you're a primary school teacher and history isn't the only thing that you do. So anybody can nominate, right? You can nominate yourself. You can nominate a teacher that you admire and think should be celebrated. And we're going to be looking at different ways in which they can maybe excel. There isn't just one single way to route to the top here.
Did you have, as a child, an incredibly inspiring history teacher yourself?
I did. I was lucky
hoping
enough,
you'd say that.
I was lucky enough to have three that I particularly remember. There was Ms. Darcy, who had red hair and she was awfully glamorous.
Right.
And she was in the trade union and she was always going out of the class to make important phone calls. And then there was Mr. King and there was Mr. Carruthers. And I've met them all again as grown-ups, but I still can't quite believe they have first names.
No, we don't really want to go there, do we? Even in adult life.
Too intimate.
Why were they so good? What did they do?
They were people who seemed to... They were people I wanted to be. They seemed to know a lot, be interesting in the way that they talked about it. And I just looked forward to those lessons. That's the secret of, I don't know, is that the secret of a good teacher? I look forward to the lessons. I thought the lessons were fun. It did seem like work.
Okay. Is it the curriculum that sometimes lets history teaching down? Because we know at the moment that some teachers feel under immense pressure to tick the boxes, to get the children through the exams, just do it, just get through the day. It can be pretty turgid, can't it?
I'm not an expert on life in the classroom. The sort of history I do is for definition, is by definition for people who are outside the classroom, you know, people who are just interested. But it's my instinct that almost anything can be interesting. People are always saying to me, which part of history do you find the most interesting? And my answer is, whatever bit I'm going to look at next. Because I know that even if I don't think that I'm interested in the politics of the 1930s, I only have to read two books. And then I'm there. And I'm like, oh, I'm starting to make connections between the different things that I'm read. And I think I never want to go anywhere else. But in my work, I do skip through the centuries quite gaily.
Right. OK. Well, there isn't really a boring part of history.
No, exactly. Everything has a history too. The history of, I don't know, rubber balls, the shower, underpants, the kettle.
Well, I've always thought social history is often quite quickly forgotten, isn't it? But hugely important. I remember being really quite obsessed when we went through COVID that our knowledge of the Spanish flu epidemic...
Oh, it suddenly skyrocketed.
Well, all of a sudden we started thinking about it and asking about it, but it had just disappeared from the collective memory, seemingly, which it shouldn't have done, should it?
Also, the invention of the quarantine that happened in the Venetian Republic in response to the Black Death. It's only called the quarantine because the ships coming from the east had to wait 40 days in the lagoon before people were allowed to come into Venice. If it had been 50 days, we'd be talking about the cinquantine instead.
See, this is why we need you in every day, Lucy.
Oh.
Well, perhaps not. No, it's absolutely vital. So how do you make a judgment, or how will you make a judgment about who wins here?
Well, we're going to look at all the cases that come in from the nominated people, and they may do well because they are using creative approaches to teaching history that we haven't heard of before. They may do well because they are broadening the range of stories that are getting told. We're interested in teachers who are bringing out neglected, forgotten, traditionally overlooked stories. It could be that they use heritage sites and original sources in exciting ways. That's certainly something I remember from the classroom. Because part of the subtext here, to be honest, is that we want teachers to know that they can come and visit the Tower of London and all the wonderful resources that there are for teachers that the charity Historic Royal Palaces supports. And maybe they are going to be people who are champions of history within the school. So maybe they run a history club or something like that that'll get non-historians interested in the subject.
Right. Thinking about the Tower of London, the terrible break-in at the Louvre. I mean, I was thinking, in fact, I think I asked yesterday about the crown jewels. Are you beefing up security matters?
I cannot possibly comment on matters of security.
But there are some priceless things in there, aren't there?
There are some of the greatest national treasures. I think that people think the Louvre is particularly vulnerable, though, because you always see it getting broken into in feature films. It happens the whole time, doesn't it?
They do seem to be a little vulnerable too. In the Da Vinci Code, there's a lot going on there, isn't there? Is it possible that teachers can teach history without ever giving away their personal politics?
That's a very interesting question because, of course, the political is inherent in history. I think I would like to think that I do that. I make history political, but without thrusting my own politics down people's throats, except in certain areas. I don't think anybody knows how I vote, for example. I want to keep that. I want to keep that secret, really. My history is a big tent that everybody's welcome in.
I'm just looking at our message board here, and there's a lively debate this afternoon about the monarchy.
Oh, yes.
And not surprisingly. And we did have a passionate message from a Nigel who just wants, he's had enough, he wants the monarchy to go. Elizabeth says, no, our royal family are an enormous asset for the country. Countries all over the world look at ours with envy at our stable, historical and respected royal family. Apart from Andrew, says Elizabeth. And Peter says, I thought Nigel put it very well. Having one family with the exclusive right to produce our head of state without any criteria of morals or ability, Peter thinks it's a nonsense.
Mm.
With your historian hat on, do you think the monarchy will survive for the next 50 years?
I would imagine that it probably will, not least because it doesn't have the significant power for it really, for people to invest all that much in tearing it down? I mean, it's not an absolute monarchy. It doesn't have a major role in government. So I would have thought that the Republican argument, you know, there are other things going on in the world today than to worry about the British monarchy. But I could be wrong. Perhaps there'll be some enormous uprising.
At least one person thinks you should be the monarch, Lucy.
Oh, well, there's an idea. Yes, OK, cancel all of that. Yes, I shall take the crown.
I thought that would make you change your mind. So very, very briefly, how do people nominate an individual for this award?
If you look on a search engine for Historic Royal Palaces Teaching Awards, you'll find the nomination page. It only opened today and people have been nominating themselves, each other already. It's very exciting.
Well, brilliant. I mean, history is a great subject. It's a fantastic subject to study. Lucy, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
Lucy Worsley. And next, why does President Trump keep flip-flopping on supporting Ukraine? This is Times Radio. It's just after 2:30. Here are the headlines. Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Grooming gang victims are being assured they can have confidence in the national inquiry after two survivors resigned from a panel to help organise it. Fiona Goddard accused the Home Office of secretive conduct, including about the appointment of the investigation's chair. Ellie Ann Reynolds claimed the scope's being widened to downplay racial motivations behind the abuse, something the government denies. Shadow Home Secretary Chris Phillips says it's a disgrace.
The government has said nothing substantive publicly, and their inquiry is descending into chaos. What we have heard publicly is that victims and survivors on the liaison panel have no confidence in the government and no confidence in the inquiry.
The Shadow Justice Secretary, Robert Jenrick, says he would probably ban the burqa if he were in government. The former Conservative leadership candidate advocated for the ban when asked about it on a phone-in on Talk. It is not official party policy. Boris Johnson's told the COVID inquiry that his government didn't fail to plan for coronavirus school closures. The former Prime Minister says the need for such preparations was obvious, but admits children paid a huge price to protect society. It's understood a member of the King's household was head of royal protection when Prince Andrew allegedly asked one of his police officers to dig up dirt on Virginia Giuffre. Lord Peter Roslin, now personal secretary to the King and Queen, was head of royalty and diplomatic protection between 2003 and 2014. And the former chief constable of Northamptonshire Police has been charged over allegations he lied about and exaggerated his military rank and record. He's accused of fraud and misconduct in public office for the claims he made when applying to work for the force. The Crown Prosecution Service says the 56-year-old will appear in court next month. And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
For over 100 years, Save the Children has been working to keep children safe, healthy and learning in the UK and around the world. Its work wouldn't be possible without the help of those who support with a gift in their will. This is Anne from Caerphilly in Wales, who shares with us why she's decided to include a gift in her will to Save the Children.
I feel really passionate to support Save the Children. It's very important for children to understand that there is a life out there that they can take part in without fear. Save the Children is helping children in war, conflict or in poverty, and the legacy that I will leave will help it continue with our work in the future.
From birth to adulthood, Save the Children is there to provide the support children need to stay safe, healthy and learning. Find out more about leaving a gift in your will. Search Save the Children Gifts in Wills. Save the Children is a registered charity.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens.
8 new kitchen styles now available, with prices starting from under £3,000. Whether you choose dusky pink, hazy blue, or one of the other new styles, you'll be delighted with your kitchen transformation. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
It is Times Radio. It's 23 minutes now to 3 o'clock. Thanks for your messages about largely the royals, it has to be said, this afternoon. Elizabeth Clare says, I'm surprised that more people haven't come round to feeling uncomfortable with the idea of a royal family. Many members appear to be honest and hardworking, but not all of them. And there are others. I'm afraid we're slightly late to get on with everything else, but I will go back to them. John Pienaar has news of his programme between 4 and 7.
Yeah, I've got a range of stories on the programme today. I'll mention just one or two. Ukraine. Because you might have seen the news yesterday, John Healey, the Defence Secretary, he was saying there's £100 million now put aside for Britain to play a part in this coalition of the willing of British forces ready to go in and guard the peace when peace comes to Ukraine. Now, that's now being, I don't know, people in some quarters rather sniggering about this coalition, calling it the coalition of the waiting. It's not doing anything. Putin seems to have a veto over the whole thing. And now, Kurt Volker, who's a former US ambassador, who's a former special envoy to Ukraine for the United States, he's saying, go in now. He wants those troops into Ukraine now. He wants NATO jets flying over the Ukraine-NATO border now. And to take the initiative away, call Putin's bluff, which is bold stuff. So I'm going to be talking to Kurt Volker on the show at 5 o'clock. I'm talking to General Ben Hodges, as a former commanding general of the US Army in Europe, and to a Finnish general, to catch up on that story and all that it means. I'm also going to be watching Gaza, J.D. Vance, arriving there. What difference can it make? What can he really achieve? Talking about that and looking at that story of Michelle Phillips. I'm talking to Michelle Phillips, who's a lecturer in music psychology and a researcher into Parkinson's, about the woman who played the clarinet while she was having surgery on her brain.
Yes, I mean, have you seen the film?
I have.
It's absolutely incredible.
She's just chatting to the surgeons while they're burrowing away in her brain and playing the clarinet.
Yeah, it's almost like we do need experts, isn't it? Just every now and again you think, yeah, I wouldn't want a keen amateur doing that. The operation, that is, not playing the instrument. Although, to be fair, to hear it in its... You do need someone who knows what they're doing, don't you? John, thank you very much indeed. John Pienaar, live on Times Radio between 4 and 7. And actually, we're going to talk about that extraordinary operation and the musician who was being operated on in the company of our resident GP, Dr. Rachel Ward, before 3 o'clock, actually, this afternoon. And just a reminder that our guest after 3:30 is the journalist Amy Wallace, who helped Virginia Giuffre write her book Nobody's Girl, which is out today. And actually, I noticed, was already in the top 10 Audible books, so people have rushed to listen to the book, and I can only assume that they're actually buying the hardback as well. Now, world leaders, including Keir Starmer and other European heads of state, have backed Ukraine after yet another U-turn from President Trump. The US president suggested yesterday that Ukraine couldn't win the war with Russia. He also pushed Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to give up the Donbass province after a phone call with President Putin of Russia last week. Let's talk to Sarah Baxter, the director of the Marie Colvin Centre for International Reporting. Sarah, well, we've been here before, haven't we? Donald Trump does have a tendency to believe the last person he spoke to on this.
Well, yes, absolutely. And of course, Zelensky was very much looking forward to his meeting in Washington. It was going to go very well. It looked friendly on the outside, but the shouting match on the inside was very unwelcome, I think, to the Ukrainians, because Donald Trump, as you suggest, had just been speaking to Vladimir Putin. Certainly Tomahawk cruise missiles were off the table for Ukraine, and now Donald Trump wants to have another stab at peacemaking one-to-one between himself and Vladimir Putin while bossing Zelensky around.
Can we just come back to you in a moment? We want to bring in Maxim Tucker, who's the Times Ukraine reporter. Maxim, Trump is now claiming that this war just isn't winnable for Ukraine, which wasn't what he was saying not that long ago. What is the reality?
Well, it depends on how you define winning, and obviously there are lots of different variables that are involved in winning a war. I mean, Ukraine maintaining its sovereignty and being able to maintain that for the foreseeable future, having a sustainable future, that would be, for many people, winning the war. And to do that, it needs guarantees, security guarantees. Now, to win the war on the battlefield against Russia is obviously a different task. It's extremely difficult. But there are certain things that Ukraine's allies could do to change that calculus. I mean, if we're talking about having an air policing mission over the west of Ukraine, maybe west of the Dnipro, shooting down unmanned drones and jets that fly over that territory, that would do a great deal to helping Ukraine's ability to fight Russia, to drive Russia back. I mean, I think territorial gains by Ukraine at this point look very unlikely, but there are lots of things that the Allies could do and haven't done to help Ukraine win on the battlefield as well.
Right. And is there hope in Ukraine that Europe will actually properly deliver and soon?
Well, the Ukrainians are very frustrated that Europe hasn't woken up still, even though now the rhetoric has changed from European leaders and they're talking more about realising the dangers. And, you know, Russian drones over Poland have caused some consternation. The money isn't there to back it up in quite the same way. And the bureaucracy of kind of building new weapons, delivering weapons, creating new armies to face down the Russians, to deter the Russians, it's still incredibly slow going. I mean, we're still talking about years in the future where Europe might be ready to actually fight a war against Russia. And in the meantime, Ukraine is Europe's best bet for defending itself. Ukraine has a million strong armed forces, which nowhere else in Europe can muster. So Europe really, it's in its own best interest to equip Ukraine as best it can, because Ukraine is Europe's best form of defence against Russia.
I know that you have written quite a lot about some of the incredible innovations made by Ukraine during the course of this conflict. I think the truth is that will have an impact on, well, you tell me, on presumably the future of warfare.
Yeah, warfare tomorrow will look completely different from how it has done in previous wars. I mean, now we have drones launching drones, drones being given bigger range by other drones in the air, repeating signals, autonomous weapons that can hunt down and kill individuals in the last kilometre. The capability is there to send a drone on a completely autonomous mission for hundreds of miles. I think they will also change the security calculus of all kinds of things in the future as well. I mean, it's astonishing to me that we haven't seen a drone assassination or at least a drone assassination attempt so far. I mean, with FPV drones being able to be flown the way they are. So I think drones will change the way wars are fought. And Europe, again, is scrambling to kind of catch up on that front. It's beginning to realise that Ukrainians have developed the cutting edge technology and trying to bring some in from Ukraine
right.
to Europe.
I mean, that's a terrifying prospect, a drone assassination. But you used FPV there. That means what, Maxim?
It's a first-person view drone. So it's a drone that you control by strapping on a pair of goggles and seeing what the drone sees, even if you're flying it remotely from tens of miles away. And these are being used on the battlefield in Ukraine to hunt down individual soldiers who are running away from the drones. Then some explosive attached to it. So you can very effectively target individuals with these kind of weapons.
Very briefly, if the war were to end tomorrow, frozen, everything frozen as it is now, how much land would Ukraine give up or have to give up?
So we're talking about 20% of Ukrainian territory that Russia currently occupies. That is about the size of Poland, sorry, not size of Poland, the size of Hungary or Portugal. So it's a serious amount of land from already a very large country that Ukraine would be able to expect it to give up. But I think what is more important for the Ukrainians is a guarantee that kind of giving up or temporarily surrendering that land to the Russians doesn't just give Russia a platform from which to launch more attacks in the future. They need to see that the US is behind them, Europe is behind them, and that any further attempts by Russia to take more territory or to end Ukraine's sovereignty, which is still ultimately the end goal here, will be thwarted.
Thank you very much, Maxim Tucker, the Times Ukraine reporter. Sarah, is there any chance that Donald Trump will finally come to the realisation that President Putin may very well be playing him?
I think he did feel that. He felt the lack of respect from Vladimir Putin after the Alaska summit when nothing happened and, in fact, attacks on civilians in Ukraine intensified. But I think Trump sees himself as a sort of Kissingerian realist in this. When he says Ukraine can't win, it doesn't mean that he thinks that Ukraine should therefore fold. And I think there is a misreading here. I mean, he does think, and I think fair enough, like many Ukrainians, that Europe should step up. And meantime, he thinks that on the battlefield, Putin can't advance and Ukraine is not capable of winning its territory back. And therefore, he's really talking more about you've got to give up not all of that region, but freeze the lines where they are. And in some ways, we're just back to square one when Donald Trump came in. And I don't think that this is necessarily unreasonable to say, well, why don't we try and have a ceasefire now and then build up security guarantees of the kind that Maxim was talking about. And so what you're seeing is differences of tone rather than substance on where we've been now over the future of Ukraine for a while. And he needs to cajole, Trump thinks he needs to cajole Putin into a ceasefire, because otherwise Putin could, you know, Trump says he's got all the cards because Putin's got the nuclear missiles. And then so cajole Putin and bully Zelensky into coming to some sort of agreement. That's the tactics that he's decided are likely to be most effective. It doesn't mean necessarily that this is such a disaster for Ukraine, because I think Ukraine would desperately like peace, but it wants peace, as Maxim says, that it can, that is for the future, for the long term.
And just a brief word on President Trump's reported inclusion in the so-called Epstein files. I should say that we're going to be hearing on Times Radio from Amy Wallace, the journalist who helped Virginia Giuffre write her memoir. That's after 3:30 this afternoon. Is that still something that is setting America aflame? Are people still talking about the Epstein files and President Trump's possible involvement?
Not much, I'm afraid. Of course, with the Epstein files, you never know whether they've subsided and they're going to come back to bite, as Peter Mandelson found and as Prince Andrew has found for decades. Every time he thinks he's escaped the coils, then something else happens. The Americans are kind of interested in what's happened to Prince Andrew, but they don't get the distinction between losing the title Duke of York and being called Prince Andrew, which, you know, sounds more like Prince Charming and quite nice, really.
They're not alone in being baffled there, I don't think.
Yeah, and then for Donald Trump, he has really sat on his own supporters over this, and he is saved by one crucial thing. Firstly, the government is in shutdown, so Congress is not sitting. There isn't a majority. Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, is refusing to sit, a Democrat, has done for weeks, a recently elected one in Arizona, so that she can't be the casting vote to release the so-called Epstein files, in which Donald Trump's name does appear. But the other saving grace for Donald Trump is, for whatever reason, he did stop being friends with Epstein before Epstein was convicted of sex offences. And there is a distinction there. However much we think they were pally and used to play around together or whatever, he did give up his friendship with Epstein. Now, very likely for his own reasons, but Lord Mandelson and Prince Andrew didn't have the wit to do that.
No, it's a very good point. Thank you for making it. Sarah Baxter, the director of the Marie Colvin Centre for International Reporting. You're listening to Times Radio. It's 3:09 and playing the clarinet as somebody operates on your brain. We'll have that and more medical news with our resident GP. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Win an unforgettable cultural adventure on Times Radio with The Widow, the new legal thriller from John Grisham. Enter now at times.radio for the chance to experience the immersive Picasso exhibition at Tate Modern. Enjoy lunch and panoramic views across London in the gallery's rooftop restaurant, plus two-night stay in a four-star hotel. Expand your cultural capital with Times Radio and The Widow, the unforgettable new legal thriller from John Grisham. Out now from all good booksellers.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Stayshore. What is Stayshore? Stayshore is not just the UK's favourite travel insurance. StaySure is the confidence that comes with knowing that you're covered by the company with more five-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other provider. A company that welcomes people of all ages with pre-existing medical conditions for single or multiple trips. So StaySure with StaySure Travel Insurance. UK's favourite relates to number of five-star Trustpilot reviews, T's and C's and verifications at staysure.co.uk/reviews.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier, all built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
You never forget the dogs you've loved. They have the power to steal our hearts, to love us unconditionally, and be there for us when we need them most, without saying a word. You understand how a dog can change a life. A guide dog can transform the life of someone living with sight loss. Will you help change someone else's life with a gift in your will to guide dogs? Request our free will guide today. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
Guide Dogs.
This is Times Radio.
And it's good just to get the chance to be positive about something. Let's talk about that incredible story about the woman undergoing surgery for Parkinson's who played her clarinet on the operating table after experiencing instant improvement in her finger movements as an electrical current was delivered to her brain. Dr. Rachel Ward is our resident GP, co-host of the Pharmacy podcast, joins us every week on a Tuesday to discuss health matters. This is truly miraculous to me, Rachel. How could it happen?
Good afternoon. Yeah, so this is a procedure called deep brain stimulation, which is used for some people who suffer with Parkinson's disease. So Parkinson's disease occurs when you get a degeneration of some cells in your brain which produce dopamine. And this essentially, therefore, stops signals passing through your brain and stops the passage of electrical stimulant going through your brain. So what deep brain stimulation does is it puts in a tiny little transmitter deep into your brain tissue and puts out electrical signals. It has a box a bit similar to a pacemaker, if you like, and therefore replaces what those cells do. I mean, obviously, that is a very simplistic explanation of something incredibly complex, but you're absolutely right. You know, this is incredible to see that we are at a stage where somebody can have something implanted in their brain to take over those degenerated cells and give them some movement back again, which is obviously such a challenging thing with Parkinson's.
So not a cure, but certainly something that could be used as a treatment.
Yeah, it's not a cure, and it's something, you know, it is a degenerative disease and it continues to progress even if you have this implanted and you have to have ongoing input with other elements. But it is something which can be very beneficial for those who have exhausted medication, but also you have to have a very specific type and respond to it.
Let's talk about Leslie Regan. She is the government's Women's Health Ambassador, and she's worried about the state of women's healthcare in the UK, saying that, frankly, it hasn't really improved much in the last 30 years. First of all, do you agree with her?
I think, if being really honest, I think I look at some of the situations with women's health in the UK, and I would agree that some of it is quite embarrassing. You know, the fact that we have 600,000 women on waiting lists waiting for gynaecological procedures. And when you see that firsthand, I think often these statistics can be quite shocking. But when you actually see that firsthand of the women that are waiting for these things and how it's affecting their day-to-day life, how it's, you know, stopping them from working, affecting, you know, losing their jobs, for example, because they are waiting for procedures, you really realise how far we have to go.
What kind of procedures, Rachel?
So a huge range. So, for example, things like hysteroscopies, where you have a camera going into the uterus for biopsies or treatment. People wait for a long time for that. There is very typically, and I'm talking about my area, but I suspect this is quite wide ranging, you know, people waiting for things like endometriosis clinics and right. procedures for endometriosis, which are obviously really impactful diseases. Very long waits for things like that, which, you know, it is not good quality of care.
No, I know that endometriosis can just be such a negative thing to have in your life. It really does, if not ruin your life, certainly goes,
yes.
doesn't go anywhere near enhancing it, that's for certain. A very brief word on rising rates of obesity leading to a cancer epidemic. I mean, we have got, most of us have got the message by now that being obese is not good for you, full stop.
Yeah, so this latest research from the Institute for Cancer Research, what it has shown, so there's been a lot of concern about rising rates of cancer in younger people and potentially thinking that is due to obesity rates. What this study has shown is that actually in the majority of cancers, the rates are increasing across all adult ages, which this is really important when we are focused on future management plans, future strategy. We need to, of course, be considering younger adults and occurrence, but it just shows us the importance of considering cancer in all ages and also that potential link to obesity and how we continue to tackle that.
Right. I mean, is there, are people, GPs, I'm looking at you, Rachel, will you say to a patient, you know what, if you don't lose 3 or 4 stone, you're putting yourself in the danger zone?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what's important is that we always acknowledge how complex and difficult obesity is. And it's really not as simple as telling someone to lose weight. But yeah, I really feel like it's my duty to tell people that, you know, to ask them how we can help, I think is the main thing, and ask how we can try and tackle their weight issues and support them with that. And there are ways to helping people, but also just recognizing that it's a very complex issue.
Thank you very much indeed, Rachel.
Thank you.
Dr. Rachel Ward is our GP, joins us every single Tuesday on the programme. She is the co-host of The Pharmacy Podcast. This from Chris, the Prince Andrew discussion. Why are there no questions about the identity of the other men who allegedly abused Virginia Giuffre? Why is Andrew the only one who's been named? Why don't we know the other names? Is nobody trying to find out who they are or were? Chris, I hope you can still listen to Times Radio after 3:30 when I'm going to be talking to Amy Wallace, who is the award-winning American journalist and co-author of Virginia Giuffre's memoir, published tragically posthumously today. So that's in the next hour of the programme. It's almost 3 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio until 4 o'clock, and as well as Amy Wallace in the next hour. Could tax rises be guaranteed as government borrowing soars? I'm going to be talking to an economist who advised the last government. Boris Johnson says school closures felt unavoidable during the coronavirus pandemic, but the rules were far too complex. We'll hear about his evidence today to the COVID inquiry. Here's the news at 3 from Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Conservatives are urging ministers to get a grip on an inquiry into grooming gangs after two victims quit a panel helping establish it. Eliane Reynolds accused the Home Office of trying to minimise the racial and religious motivations behind her abuse. Another survivor, Fiona Goddard, claimed a toxic environment would lead to people feeling silenced all over again. Safeguarding Minister Jess Phillips has responded in the Commons.
Allegations of intentional delay, lack of interest, or widening of the inquiry scope and dilution are false. The inquiry will remain laser focused on grooming gangs, as Baroness Casey recommended.
It's understood the King's aide was the head of royal protection when Prince Andrew allegedly asked one of his police officers to dig up dirt on Virginia Giuffre. Lord Peter Roslin was head of royalty and diplomatic protection between 2003 and 2014. It's not clear if he was made aware of Andrew's request at the time. Prince Andrew has always denied Ms. Giuffre's accusations. Elsewhere, Gloria Allred, a lawyer for Jeffrey Epstein victims, says he needs to speak up.
The person who is not speaking is Prince Andrew. He's the one that chooses silence now. And of course, now he's trying to make it seem that he's doing his duty by not being a so-called distraction to the king. What about his duty to the victims?
And you can hear from the co-author of Virginia Giuffre's memoir, Amy Wallace, with Jane on Times Radio in about half an hour's time. The former Chief Constable of Northamptonshire Police has been charged with fraud and misconduct in public office after allegedly lying about his military service. The Independent Office for Police Conduct said Nick Adderley is accused of making false claims of being a decorated Navy officer while applying to work for the force. The Crown Prosecution Service said he's also alleged to have lied about his educational achievements. He'll appear at Westminster Magistrates Court next month. Two more arrests have been made over the murder of former Lost Prophets singer Ian Watkins in prison. Watkins was killed at Wakefield Prison, where he was serving a sentence for child sex offences earlier this month. The two male inmates have been questioned by police, while two other men have already been charged with murder and appeared in court last week. Boris Johnson has admitted he regrets picking the wrong model to replace exams in the summer of 2020. The former Prime Minister has been giving evidence to the COVID inquiry. GCSE and A-level students had teacher-predicted grades cut by a government algorithm, sparking anger and forcing ministers to scrap the sixth system. The ex-PM says it was all done for a reason.
To try to ensure that their qualifications would be as valuable in the future as those of any other. Yeah, that was the intention. It failed in that intention, I perfectly accept. It was not done with bad intent.
And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. It's Jane Garvey here on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. Fee, not very well today, but very much back with us very soon, I am sure. John Pienaar awaits with a pulsating late afternoon and evening of news for you between 4 o'clock and seven. But don't go anywhere. We've got lots to talk about between now and 4 o'clock, including Amy Wallace with us, the award-winning US journalist and the woman who Virginia Giuffre chose to help her write her memoir, Nobody's Girl, which is out today. First, though, the Chancellor is pledging to save businesses £6 billion a year by cutting red tape in attempts to convince the budget watchdog to upgrade the UK's growth forecasts. Now, Rachel Reeves has been speaking to 350 business leaders and mayors at a regional investment summit in Birmingham about how she's going to boost growth. But the overall economic outlook does look a bit gloomy as borrowing figures have hit a five-year high. Tim Leunig is chief economist at Nesta, former advisor to Tory Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Very briefly, Mr. Leunig, what is Nesta?
Nesta is a social innovation agency. We sit on a large endowment and we try and use it for the public good.
Right. OK, so you're well above board these days then. That's good. That's good to
know.
Yeah,
completely. I'm not here to sell you anything.
No. OK. And you're not. I mean, are you speaking genuinely from a political perspective or are these simply your thoughts? Tell me, Tim.
No, I'm not speaking from a political perspective at all. I was always a neutral civil servant. I have absolutely no axe to grind for or against Rachel Reeves. I respect her as a fellow economist. I think she's doing the best she can in difficult circumstances.
OK, thank you very much. Now, today she's going to try and save businesses £6 billion quid a year by cutting red tape. I mean, cutting red tape, that is one of the oldest tropes around, isn't it? Is it possible?
Well, it's definitely possible. I mean, there is a lot of red tape around. You ask anyone who's a small business about the difficulties of filing a VAT return, or even you ask any self-employed person about filling in their annual tax certificate. So she has identified some specific things about reports to companies, house, etc., that will definitely help. But £6 billion is a lot of money to claim. but it's also not that big in the scale of an economy that is £2,700 billion large. You know, we're talking here about roughly a third of 1%. So although the OBR may score it, they're not suddenly going to say, wow, you're going to grow like nothing we've seen before.
Right. The budget is still, is it 5 weeks away? It just doesn't seem to get any closer. I don't know how you're feeling about it, but the speculation is doing most of us no good at all. What do you think she will do about taxes?
Well, she'll put them up. And she'll put them up a long way. And I hope she puts them up at the top end of what people are expecting. Because if she goes into next year sort of 25 billion in the black, then we can get out of all this endless fear that she'll have to raise taxes next year. And that really is harmful for growth, because when people think taxes will rise next year, they stop spending money. And then all sorts of businesses end up in trouble. And when the markets know she might have to unexpectedly borrow money over the year because she doesn't have enough money spare, then the money markets get worried and we all end up paying through the nose through higher gilt rates.
Right.
So okay. I'm hoping for very big tax rises.
Right. So if we don't want borrowing figures to hit a five-year high, as they have done today, we've got to swallow walloping great tax rises, according to you.
Or walloping great spending cuts. I mean, she could stand up and say, you know what, universal infant free school meals, they're lovely, but we're going to stop giving middle class people a free meal for their little kid in school. She could do that sort of stuff. And she tried to do some stuff like that last year and her backbenchers defeated her. So given her backbenchers keep defeating any spending cuts, then I think her only option pretty much is tax rises.
Okay, who would you tax? And you've said you want it to be at the higher end. So how high do you think it's reasonable to go? And who is going to be most impacted?
Well, I hope the person who's most impacted is me. I wrote a thing to my former colleagues in the Treasury recently saying pretty much they should stick a picture of me on the wall and throw darts at it. Because I'm 50-odd, I've almost paid off my mortgage, my daughter has left home, I have a decent salary. I'm exactly the sort of person they should be sitting down and thinking, how can we clobber Tim?
Right, OK. You've been so honest. Do you mind just telling me what your, I mean, what are your annual earnings? Are we talking about somebody who's fortunate enough to earn a six-figure sum every year? Can we put it
yes,
like that?
Yes, I earn a low six-figure sum. I have more than one job, so I don't actually know the figure off the top of my head. But yes, it's low six figures.
Right, OK. And again, thank you for your honesty. Much appreciated. So you would say anyone in that kind of bracket needs to gird their loins and be prepared?
Well, I think they should be prepared. I'm not saying everyone on my sort of income is rolling in money. There are people with my sort of income who have taken out really quite big mortgages, often to buy pretty average houses in London. So I'm not saying everyone on my income is rolling in it, though clearly anyone in my income is well above average compared to the rest of the country. And yes, my shoulders are not physically broad, but financially, it's people like me they need to target, not people who are poor and struggling day to day.
But, I mean, you've already made the point, Tim. I don't want to repeat it, but it is a plain fact that some people on, you know, six-figure salaries, let's say 110 grand, might well have two children, let's say they're paying for their education. They might have a child at university. They may or may not have a partner. Their partner may or may not be working. There are individuals involved here and everybody's circumstances are different.
Of course, 30 years ago, Peter Lilly said, if you want me to save £1 billion, please tell me the million people you want me to make £1,000 worth off. And today, if we need to save 10, 20, 30 billion, that's an awful lot of people who are £1,000 or £10,000 worth off. I'm not saying this is easy at all. It really isn't. Rachel Reeves has a genuinely difficult task. She was left a terrible inheritance by Jeremy Hunt, who really shouldn't have spent the money he didn't have. Brexit isn't helping. Donald Trump isn't helping. Her own decisions last year, for example, to freeze fuel duty, have left her in a worse position now than she needed to be. So there's lots of people who really haven't made the tough decisions they should have done over the last 5 years. And so they're all basically, in a cliche, coming home to roost.
Yeah. Can we just briefly draw everyone's attention to this pretty worrying warning from the Bank of England about the collapse of two US firms. Now, one is a subprime auto lender, so presumably you go there for your car loans, that's Tricolor or Tricolor. The other is a supplier of car parts, First Brands. Now, they've both collapsed. What are we to make of this?
Well, first of all, some companies always go bust. And companies that sell, I believe the car firm sold the cars as well as doing the finance.
Right.
That's a model that's always vulnerable. So I wouldn't want to read too much into it. But still, it's a straw in the wind. It tells us that people in America are suffering. Bluntly, as economists would predict, when you get a president who is as economically illiterate as Donald Trump. Tariffs are bound to hit Americans sooner or later. And when you hit Americans as a whole, the people who suffer are the people who are already in debt. They have something like a car. They stop paying the monthly payment. And then the car firm is in deep trouble. The finance firm is in deep trouble. Because what can they do? They can repossess a car that is now older, tattier and worth less money than when they sold it.
So you're not comparing the collapse of these two companies to the, well, to those failures of those subprime mortgage lenders that we all remember just before the crash in 2008?
I think that's unlikely, but the Bank of England are right to warn that this is something that needs monitoring. But so long as it stays where it is, one isolated company, then the world will go on. This is not a proper bank that has collapsed as such.
Right.
But the bank is right to warn that we don't know really who owns this debt, whether the debt has been parcelled up and sold on, and who knows who actually holds it.
I think it was last week, could have been the week before, we were all worrying about a potential stock market crash because of the AI bubble. Has that gone away, or is that still something we ought to stick on our worry list?
Oh, for Americans, that should absolutely be on their worry list. American stocks are looking very, very highly priced. And in every previous boom, lots of companies have gone bust, which isn't to say AI won't have big economic effects. But if we go back almost 200 years, we had a huge boom in Britain in railway shares, and most of them went bankrupt, but we did end up with some fantastic railways. And the same will be true this time. Some people will make a fortune in the AI boom, some people will lose a fortune, but the world as a whole will almost certainly end up with a very effective technology that would be good for growth.
Thank you very
much. There's no real AI boom in British stock markets, so right. I wouldn't be particularly worried about that.
Okay, just a listener says, Tim can pay more tax if he wants to by gifting to HMRC. There you go, Tim. Well, yes. I'm sure you knew that anyway.
That, and you can also give money to charity, which is usually, depending on what you want HMRC and HMT to spend the money on, a better thing for affluent and rich people to do.
I really appreciate you coming on, Tim. Enjoy talking to you. Thank you very much. That's Tim Loynig, Chief Economist at Nesta, former advisor to Rishi Sunak, who incidentally is joining the Sunday Times as a columnist. That was announced today. Now, another former Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has been giving evidence to the COVID inquiry about the effects of the government's response to the pandemic on young people. He accepts that children paid a huge price to protect the rest of society during the lockdowns and described the closing of schools as a nightmare idea. Let's hear his response to a question about the reopening of schools just for just one day, I think we all remember this, in the January of 2021.
I mean, of all the really, really low moments it was terrible, that whole period, because, I could see the cavalry coming over the hill in the form of the vaccines. I thought mass testing offered a way forward, but it was clear that, the January spike, I think, was bigger than the April spike of 2020. Were there other options we could have used at any stage to reduce the R other than closing schools? Was that really the right tool to use? Looking back, honestly, I'm not certain, but at the time, it seemed like the only option.
Boris Johnson giving evidence at the COVID inquiry today. Laura McInnery is an education journalist and co-founder of the teacher polling organisation Teacher Tap. It's interesting listening to Boris Johnson, isn't it? He is admitting there that children paid a huge price. From what we know now and from what you know, just how deep has that impact been actually on teachers and children and how the children feel?
I mean, it had undoubtedly an enormous impact, both on the young people who missed out on time at school, many of them on things that they couldn't be made up again. So those who missed their GCSEs and A-levels, those who missed leaving school, for example, those who ended primary school and didn't get to go on their residential trips, those are milestones that you can't make up for. I think the impact of the particular day, which Boris Johnson was talking about there, where after the Christmas at 2020, they got everybody back for one day on the 4th of January, sort of mixed all the primary school children together and then sent them home again. Yeah. And that is the one that lives on as particularly unforgivable. We were polling on that day around stress and anxiety levels, and they were unbelievably high amongst school leaders. It was a very challenging time for them.
Yes. He did sound, I have to say, he both sounded and looked contrite today. What do teachers think about it?
It was interesting to listen to it, because what came across is that there was really a pull between him and Gavin Williamson, the education secretary, who gave evidence last week. Williamson has always said that as the education secretary, he felt he needed to be on the side of children. And so he pushed and he pushed and he pushed for schools to stay open before that Christmas, in fact, threatening to sue one school that wanted to close because of the issues with the Kent variant and the numbers going up.
Yeah.
But Boris Johnson seemed to sort of say that he was more worried about the NHS. There was lots of evidence coming in, and it was obvious that they weren't going to be able to open. What no one seems to have got to the bottom of is why he didn't come to that decision 6 hours earlier. I mean, it is quite extraordinary with all of the data and everything that was going on that he came to it so late in the day.
What do teachers believe might have been an alternative to closing schools? Indeed, was there one?
And I think sometimes people forget that this wasn't just about whether or not children were better off in schools and the number of deaths. Those are the two that get pitted against each other. What was incredibly difficult for schools from early on is if you just have a high number of people who are sick, they have something that seems like the flu and therefore they cannot work, you just don't know if you're going to have enough staff to safely open the schools.
Yeah.
And so by that January, when we did have high levels of sickness again within the population, it was entirely possible that the schools weren't going to be able to open in full. However, again, Gavin Williamson just would not have conversations at the time with the unions, who were saying, could we have some year groups in? Could we have rolling things where every child is in but only on one day of the week? He just didn't seem to want to have those conversations. And so it was an all or nothing. And then he lost on the 4th of January. And so we had a period of time then where no children were in school except for those vulnerable and key worker children.
So that's interesting. Teachers' unions did feel there was a workable alternative of some sort. I have to say, it doesn't sound particularly easy to organise, Laura, in terms of who goes in, when and where, and then you've got to throw childcare into the mix as well. I mean, it was such a difficult time for so many people. But teachers did think there might have been a way forward and that some children could have been educated at that time.
Yes, the unions were open to negotiating lots of different ways of doing things. I think also sometimes there was the medical problem, because actually if all of the children are coming each day and then the teacher becomes the vector and passes it around, yeah, it may not have been very practical. But there were certainly different conversations on the table, and also the choices of which year groups we should have been looking at. Subsequent reviews done by the Education Endowment Foundation and other groups have said that really the impact on those youngest children was quite significant, and there might have been more that could have been done for them because they could not access the online teaching like those older children could do. And so, you know, with more foresight, more planning, you probably would come to different decisions. And I think that's what Boris Johnson was trying to get across today. He realises now, with different information and knowing how it all ended, you could have come to different decisions.
Based on your experience, Laura, which group of children suffered the most? Was it teenagers? Was it those children that you mentioned leaving primary and going to secondary? Was it primary school children? Who was it?
It's really difficult to tell at the moment. Obviously, the GCSE exam grades were slightly adapted and changed over the last 5 years to mitigate any differences that were made in achievement. And that has made it hard for us to compare in terms of outcomes, how much impact it actually had. I would also say that we have seen increasing numbers of young people with mental health problems and not in employment. We don't know if that's related to the pandemic or not, but I wouldn't want to say that because 13 and 14 year olds appear to be back on track, or because 20 year olds got decent grades, or because 25 year olds, you know, lots of them did go on and get employment, that any one of them did better. I think they just all got affected very, very differently. And it will be interesting, I think, 20 years from now, one of the impacts will be when those children become the politicians of the future. I think they will have quite interesting views on education, because some of them didn't do their exams, because some of them didn't go to school, and because they lived through this. So it will be interesting to see in 20 years what the impact is, even if we can't see it now.
Yeah, and I'll always be indebted to the teachers that actually my youngest child was still at school during the pandemic, and teachers did try really, really hard. I'll always remember the rather sorry sight of the head teacher wearing a Santa hat during the Christmas assembly on a laptop.
You know. That was the year when they did nativity plays. Lots of them were done remotely. And yes, I think it is really important just to recognise that there are 9 million children in schools every day. There are 24,500 schools and 500,000 teachers, 500,000. It was a massive operation to move that offline. Everyone did the best that they could do, and the same when they came back in as well. You know, we were asking questions at the time about whether or not you were within a meter of a child, whether or not you were able to touch their exercise books, because people forget we reopened schools when there still wasn't a vaccine. It was just about a good testing regime. And actually, for those teachers, that was very scary, and they did an incredible job.
Yeah, well said. Thank you very much. Laura McInerney, who's an education journalist, co-founder of the teacher polling organisation Teacher Tap. Just a brief message from Sarah. I work for a music outreach organisation across primary and secondary schools. The children that have been impacted the most are the youngest that missed the foundation years. Today you can tell the year group that missed those early years. The behaviour in these classes can be extremely challenging, says Sarah. Now, coming up, we'll be heading to the Times Tech Summit to hear the reaction to the Tech Secretary, Liz Kendall's speech. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Build your own package with TUI. Let's go. City break or a beach escape. Lovely. Fly from your local airport.
Taxi's here.
Handy. Any day of the week. Ideal. On a TUI flight or a partner airline.
This is your captain speaking.
Nice. How many nights? 3? 5? 14? Perfect. More options, more choice. All wrapped up with a TUI smile. TUI. Live happy. Atoll and Abtra protected. Booking T's and C's apply.
My dad was a fantastic builder. Plumbing, electrics, carpentry. There was nothing he couldn't do. But he's 83 now and he can't do any of that stuff anymore. That's hard when you've always been so capable. Unfortunately, Mum died a couple of years ago now, so he does feel quite isolated. Huh. At least he did until Kerry arrived. She's been amazing. She's Dad's care professional from Home Instead. They provide the best quality care in your own home. Dad'll never want to leave that cottage. Well, he restored it practically from scratch, all on his own. We all pop over to see him whenever we can, but we've all got busy lives. So it's real peace of mind that Kerry can be there when we're not. She helps him with all the things he can't do for himself anymore. But we've told her the only thing she's allowed to do relating to building is make Dad's favourite builder's brew.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as Saints, could help. Saints has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. Saints is managed by Bailey Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baileygifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
The Times and the Sunday Times Tech Summit 2025 on Times Radio with Sky. Believe in better.
Yep, the Tech Summit is up and running. And in the last half hour, the Technology Secretary, Liz Kendall, has been talking about AI.
We are announcing that we will be consulting on bringing in a new AI growth lab, which
Some parts of the world have already used, they call them AI sandboxes, where they look at, in a safe and controlled environment, how they can actually suspend regulations to enable the development of AI. And I think it's a really interesting idea because a lot of the regulations that we have don't apply to AI. For example, they may always require a human to be making a decision, whether that's in planning or the law or even in sort of the healthcare environment. And can we actually have a safe space where we can explore the potential of AI, where you temporarily suspend those regulations? I think this is one of the things that businesses have said to us is a barrier to taking ideas, piloting them, and then rolling them out.
That was Liz Kendall, Technology Secretary. Times Radio's Rosie Wright is at the summit for us. So, an AI sandbox. Right, over to you, Rosie. What does that mean?
Yes, I was very pleased that actually Tom Whipple, the Times paper science editor, special correspondent, was on hand to help me a little bit. But in effect, a sandbox is, of course, a place to play. And previously, the tech companies here, or particularly new startups, would be thinking we've got to go to Silicon Valley, where the different sort of regulations where they can test those ideas. What we've heard from the secretary today is she wants to create a space in the UK to do that so that companies who'd like to push the barriers out a little bit can do that here in Britain, where some of the safety regulations are loosened but in a safe space, so they can push forward with their technology and do it here rather than leave the UK. She said quite a lot to say actually about the fact that she believes, and we know this government are one that want to go for growth. She says, look, we can't do that unless we better embrace technology. She's, of course, only sort of 6 weeks into the job after that cabinet reshuffle. And talking about the things we're worried about, like the jobs market, she said, yes, look, that is inevitably going to change, but what we've got to do is find the opportunity. And she gave a couple of examples of where she's seen how AI is being used, which has actually really excited her.
Teachers love it, using AI, because it does their lesson planning and it gives them their Sunday night back. But they are also using AI to teach. They think it is brilliant for teaching children. I saw one example where the child had to imagine a place they wanted to be and describe it. AI then painted the picture. And if the picture didn't look like what the child had imagined, they had to improve their vocabulary to better describe the picture. And the guy said to me, these kids, this is their future. If I don't teach them this, they will not have a future ahead of them. So big up to the primary school teachers out there. But I think in education, it may be that it's motoring ahead there more.
Well, tell me, how did Liz Kendall's speech go down, Rosie?
I think, well, really, with the people in this room, this audience, but we might at home be listening and thinking, oh my goodness, what does it mean to be a digital native that those primary school children are being taught, like, as Liz Kendall just suggested? I mean, my education, yours, of course, didn't have anything like this, particularly not a lesson which meant me describing to AI a picture and trying to get it to adapt to it. But what the people I've been speaking to are saying is, actually, those digital natives need those skills, because what is undeniable coming out of all the sessions today is that, yes, jobs will be lost, jobs will be changed, but there will be new opportunities. So when we look even now at what's happening to the graduate jobs market, we've got in the US the CEO of Ford saying in 5 years he believes 50% of jobs will be hoovered up by AI. We need that next generation coming through to have those skills right at their fingertips. At the same time, though, nervousness a little bit that we don't know where AI is going to take things. Earlier, I was speaking to one of the team behind ChatGPT, that's OpenAI, who said, look, in a year's time, he was imagining that AI could do the job that maybe would previously have taken you a week, maybe building a website and running it for you. And I said, what about in a decade? And he said, well, AI could take up the role of entire businesses and organizations. So that's technology that's only 3 years old. When ChatGPT first landed on our computers and our phones for us to use, no one here is quite sure. Yes, it's going to transform, but how, we don't really know that answer yet.
Rosie, thank you so much for that. That's Times Radio's Rosie Wright at the Tech Summit.
The Times and the Sunday Times Tech Summit 2025 on Times Radio with Sky. Believe in better.
I must be honest, I'm glad it was Rosie who went to the tech summit. She did make an assumption there about what sort of education I had and when I had it back in the 1870s. It's true that ChatGPT was just a distant dream. But Rosie is much younger than me. That's absolutely right. She acknowledged. Rosie is at the tech summit, and there'll be more throughout the day here on Times Radio about that. Now, next, our big interview of the day is with Amy Wallace, the ghostwriter of Virginia Giuffre's memoir, Nobody's Girl. There's been so much talk about the book. It is actually available in the UK today. First, let's get a check on the latest news headlines. Here's Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A third abuse survivor has resigned from their role in the government's inquiry into grooming gangs as the government is accused of mishandling the inquiry. The Conservatives accuse them of diluting the scope of the investigation. Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philp said Labour has never supported this inquiry.
When calls for a national inquiry became public in January, the Prime Minister smeared campaigners as jumping on a far-right bandwagon. Comments like that are a disgrace.
He also asked the government to appoint a judge as chair, not someone from policing or social care. Safeguarding Minister Jess Phillips said allegations of intentional delay and dilution were false. Boris Johnson insists there was no dereliction of duty in failing to plan for school closures during the coronavirus pandemic. But the former Prime Minister has told the COVID inquiry children did pay a huge price to protect society. The King's aide was reportedly the head of royal protection when Prince Andrew allegedly asked one of his police officers to dig up dirt on his accuser, Virginia Giuffre. It's not clear if he was made aware of the former Duke of York's request at the time. The man who plotted to kidnap, rape and murder Holly Willoughby has lost his appeal against his life sentence. Security guard Gavin Plum from Essex was handed a minimum term of 16 years last July. And another two men have been arrested on suspicion of murdering paedophile singer Ian Watkins. The former Lost Prophets frontman was killed at Wakefield Prison earlier this month. For roundup of news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Stop, listen, chicken. The 10 mini fillet bucket, $7.99. 10 succulent mini fillets. Buy, eat, digest. Good, repeat. Get the deal, believe in chicken.
KFC. Until 9th of November, subject to availability, participating restaurants only, excludes delivery. Full T's and C's at kfc.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. 8 new kitchen styles now available with prices starting from under £3,000. Whether you choose dusky pink, hazy blue or one of the other new styles, you'll be delighted with your kitchen transformation. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
Now, there are some sensitive topics in the next interview. If you are affected by any of the issues raised, then please email feedback@times.radio. Prince Andrew is still making the headlines in Britain. If you need reminding, he stepped back from public life in 2019 after that interview on Newsnight. In February of 2022, he reached an out-of-court settlement with Virginia Giuffre, who'd accused him of sexual assault in 2001, when she was 17 and he was 41. He denies all the allegations of wrongdoing. On Friday, Prince Andrew gave up his titles but remains a prince. Virginia Giuffre took her own life in the April of this year. Amy Wallace is the award-winning reporter chosen by Virginia to help her write her memoir, Nobody's Girl, which is out today. Amy started the conversation by telling me how they both worked so hard to ensure that every word in this book was accurate.
We knew the book had to be even more airtight than I like to keep everything, which is that probably was one of the reasons that she hired me. I've been a journalist for more than 30 years. She was incredibly forthcoming and her memory was startling. I'm not taking her word for it. I checked it. And over again, she would tell a story that might even sound outlandish or like, how could this possibly be true? This young girl was at a party on a yacht, you know, and for a model's 30th birthday. And then sometimes we got help from, again, celebrity photographers who were at the party, and these photos would surface. There's a famous one of Virginia looking very, very young in the foreground, sort of the back of Ghislaine's side of her face, you know, lurking nearby on this same party that Virginia had told me about.
I'm really glad that you mentioned that image of Virginia at the age of 17 at a party for Naomi Campbell. Anybody who looks at that photograph, effectively, it is a crime scene, isn't it? Because you can see, as you say, the waif-like figure of this teenager surrounded by ultra-sophisticates at least a decade or more older than her. Nobody called it out. No one.
Yeah. No, there's a scene in the book about that picture where another victim comes forward and tells her, I came forward. I saw you in that picture. There was no question. That was a child. And that was Virginia. So it's something that we make clear in the book, but Virginia didn't just bravely stand up against others who had abused her. She also inspired other victims who had been hurt and were terrified, just like Virginia was.
She paid a savage price for her courage in coming forward. And it is clear in the book that her physical health is really compromised. And obviously so is her mental health. And we now know that tragically she took her own life in the April of this year. Can I just ask you how you found out about that and how you felt about it?
Well, it was a Friday morning, California time. There's a very, very tight team of people who have been working on this book or involved in Virginia's life for years. And we were all in very close touch and keeping track. Have you talked to her? Have you talked to her? Making sure she was okay. What did you hear the last time? And one of those people just called me and she said, Virginia's gone. And I said, what do you mean? You know? And she said, she's dead. And I was shocked, which readers of the book may wonder about that. You know, Virginia was adamant that we talk about and acknowledge her, you know, herself as a woman in full, her highs and her lows. And we acknowledge in the book that she had attempted to kill herself before. So on the one hand, I knew that she had this sort of wolf at the door, this voice in her head, which she described to me as saying, the world will be a better place without you in it. Basically a voice that says you are worthless. And readers of this book will understand when they see what she went through in her entire life, not just with Epstein and Maxwell, but in previous situations as well, that you'll understand why she felt worthless at times.
Yes.
And even every day to some degree. And because she'd been treated like she had no worth over and over and over again by adults who had betrayed her. So that was there. And yet she was such a resilient, lovely woman. She had a sense of humor. She had numerous coping mechanisms, which we describe in the book. And so I was still shocked. I remain so sad. You know, she should be the one doing this interview. This is her triumph, this book, where she was bravely calling out not just the people who did it, but the part of our culture that still fetishizes young girls, and that has not died with Jeffrey Epstein or gone to prison with Ghislaine Maxwell. And frankly, just misogyny. It's anti-woman. It's women are here for our use. Girls are here for our use. It is that belief system that she was pointing her finger at. And she was doing that for all of us to make the world a better place, not just to tell her own story.
Of course. I don't want to interrupt, Amy, but for people who haven't read the book, you've already alluded to this, but she died at the age of 41. She says in the book that her father had sexually abused her from the age of 7. He denies this. You, I know, have talked to Virginia's mother, who, well, how can we sum up? She doesn't disbelieve the allegations that Virginia made about her father. Would that be an accurate way of describing it?
I would go further. She believes what Virginia told her, but Virginia told it to her when Virginia was an adult. I think I have talked to Lynn, Virginia's mom, at length, and to her two brothers. She has one brother 5 years older, one 5 years younger. The 5 years younger brother was too young to know what was going on. The 5 years older brother was sent away to a sort of a boarding school, basically. And so he wasn't around when a lot of it was happening in the house. I have a lot of empathy for Virginia's mom. She was dealing with her own ailing mother at the time. She was working. These were not wealthy people. These were people who were getting by, and everybody was busy, and there were three kids in the house. It is so painful to her mom to know how hurt her daughter was under her own roof, and obviously later as well. I asked her point blank, well, do you believe what she said? And she said, absolutely. She is no longer with Virginia's father.
Right. But to those people who will say, and honestly, I'm sure you, like I, have read comments over the last couple of days, incredibly ignorant, ill-informed remarks from people making the same old misogynist points. Why didn't they leave? Well, they were getting paid. They're no better than they ought to be. What's that other expression? Party girls. How do you counter all this, Amy?
Well, I think it's part and parcel of what I was just talking about. It's misogyny. It says that if women dare to speak up, that they're liars and sluts. And I guess here's how I try to explain it to people I know, and there are a lot of them, reasonable people, who are like, well, if it's so bad, just leave. What you have to understand, and what the book attempts to paint a picture of, is that when you are a young person, a child, who is introduced to the idea that grown men rape children and they don't pay a price for it, you begin to think, after a while, that's the world. That's how it works. So I just need to navigate inside that world. When you believe those things, and Virginia, as you will see, had plenty of reason to believe them, you don't think that escaping out of the front door of the Manhattan mansion, or, you know, somehow swimming, it would be impossible to swim off the island, is going to get you anywhere better.
No.
The world works like this, is what you believe. And so you just have to navigate it. And so this idea that, and I'll go further. This book is a predator's playbook. It shows you how these people, and Maxwell was arch among them, tell these girls a really weird, deranged, mixed message that is very effective. They say, you are going to sexually service us. And Ghislaine Maxwell was just as involved in the sexual abuse as Jeffrey Epstein was. But also, we posh people see that you, an impoverished girl, have promise. You can have a wonderful life. We'll help you get it. We think you are so special. And those girls, a lot of them had never been told that before, or they'd not been told it enough.
Yeah.
And it's that kept them there, as well as anything else, because they needed that.
In this country, inevitably and rightly, the focus has been on the allegations against Prince Andrew, who continues to deny the allegations. Apart from the fact that some of his titles have been removed or gone into abeyance, whatever the technical expression is, to be perfectly honest, Amy, it doesn't make a lot of sense to most of us in this country. How that translates to people outside the UK, I simply don't know. He does say, and he said in his statement on Friday, that he denies these allegations. So, bearing that denial in mind, what should he do now?
Well, you know, in his settlement with Virginia, there was a lot of verbiage about how he really feels for these victims now, even though he did not express any of that empathy in his Newsnight interview with BBC.
And nor did he say that on Friday either.
It was basically, this idea has been expressed in his voice on paper written by somebody that he cares about this issue. He thinks it's an outrage. And you think, well, he probably should. He has daughters. If he does care about that, I think there is more room for him to be more active. And by which I mean, this is a man. Well, let's leave aside what he does or does not admit to. He was in those houses. He was on that island. He was on the jets. Those jets were remodeled to have a lot of bedrooms. That was the entire way. They were gutted inside and then bedrooms. They were places to traffic girls. So he saw things that were going on. And if he cares so deeply about this, he could share that information with investigators. This is what happened. Let me validate their experience.
Have any of the other men involved done exactly that?
Not that I know of, no. In the United States, and I think that's a good point. I know we're going out to listeners in the UK, and Prince Andrew is obviously top of mind. This story is not about Prince Andrew. This story is about more than a dozen, if not dozens, of men, powerful men, who felt entitled to use these girls as their sexual playthings. In the case of Andrew, we know that he actually knew how young she was because there was a guessing game. It's in the book where Ghislaine makes him guess how old she is. Some of them might claim, I didn't even know how old they were. I don't care. They knew that Epstein surrounded himself with young women. That was part of the draw of coming to be with him. And there are a lot of them. And it was always Virginia's fondest wish that they be held to account. That's why in the United States, there is this clamoring call to release the Epstein files, because those names I know from Virginia, I know the names that she told the FBI, I know the names that she told them repeatedly. And Virginia is just one of many women who came forward bravely and talked to investigators. And I think we don't even know all of the women because some of them did it privately and have never come forward to the public, as is their right, to protect their privacy. So we do need all of us to stand up to this.
Yeah.
We need women to talk about it and men.
Yes,
and if Prince Andrew would like to lead that charge, I would welcome it.
Right. So if the truth is, though, the terrible truth, as you've indicated, is that if Prince Andrew were to come forward and describe what he saw and what he knew, he'd be the first man to actually do that. I mean, that's incredible, isn't it?
Well, I mean, of course, we all understand the concept of you are innocent until you are proven guilty. And we also understand the very basic idea that sexual abuse often happens behind a closed door, and it's often either two people involved or maybe three, if Ghislaine Maxwell is there abusing as well, which often happened. But it's a he said, she said. And those cases, any lawyer will tell you, are difficult because what happens is the victims are always vilified or made to seem like liars or drug addicts or fill in the blank, and they're hard to win. So what's happened so far, at least with the men that Virginia has named in depositions that are public, you know, those men have just said, well, we deny it.
Yeah. Which brings us on, obviously, in the States, Donald Trump, who does appear briefly in Nobody's Girl, we should say, in a very brief encounter with Virginia and her father at Mar-a-Lago. Lots of people in the States believe that he is implicated in this too. Do you believe that the Epstein files, so-called, will be made fully public in the US in the near future or at all?
Well, I have no window into that. I find it sort of mystifying that Donald Trump campaigned as one of his main planks for returning to the presidency. He campaigned on the idea that he was going to release the Epstein files, something that Virginia felt very validated by. I should say in the book, there is no scene, because Virginia had never seen any such scene, of Donald Trump abusing young underage girls. He was not one of the many men who were in the house. He wasn't hanging around.
Yeah.
And there are several men who really were, who she knew well. There were others who were kind of, would come in one or two times. But Donald Trump is not implicated in the book. I think what's important to say there is that the reason for Donald Trump's desire to release the Epstein files was so important to Virginia and others is that, again, these women had been told for years that they were not worth listening to. They had been Epstein had had a sweetheart deal made behind their backs. They were not informed, and he was allowed to theoretically be imprisoned in Florida, but also leave during the day during his prison sentence and abuse young girls while he was theoretically being incarcerated. I mean, this is, who's heard of this kind of thing?
Well,
you and I wouldn't get that treatment.
No, I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling that it was allowed to happen. But that's, I mean, we also need to make clear in the book that there's that one credible death threat that Virginia Giuffre received. The FBI were very worried about it. They took it seriously. There were mysterious episodes when strange cars would drive up to her home and their headlights would be on full beam, blasting into the house last thing at night. She felt extraordinarily vulnerable, didn't she? She was made to feel that way again. I mean, was she right to be frightened, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. This wasn't imagined paranoia. There were, as you say, the FBI alerted the family at one point that there was a credible death threat against Virginia's life. They, as you say, there were these very frightening incidents. She was home alone one night with her three kids sleeping, and there was a car right outside the front door aiming the headlights in. She got her dog, a big dog that they had at the time. She got the gun that she had specifically gotten for this purpose, and she just stood at the door and hoped they weren't going to come in, and they ultimately left. But this was a constant thing. And beyond that, you know, any victim weighs the costs of coming forward. And on the plus side, you're going to hold your abuser to account, and you're going to maybe make the world a better place and teach other people. We should all be standing up against this kind of behavior. We should all be saying, no, it's not okay for wealthy people to treat poor people this way.
Yeah.
We should all be doing that. So obviously that sounds great, but here's what you lose. You lose your privacy completely. You are endangered personally. And she did have people who had made clear to her that she better be quiet or else. So, and whether that was physical threats or threats of keeping her in court for the rest of her life.
We know, too, that Prince Andrew's people, whoever they might be, hired internet trolls to have a go at her. So they were part of it, too. And I just think it's so important that people understand that there is a massive price to be paid for speaking up. And in the end, Virginia, the poor soul, simply couldn't tolerate it anymore. And I don't know where we go from here, really. I mean, how can we make her efforts worth it? What would you like to happen now?
What I will just say, it would devastate Virginia if the takeaway from this book is, you know, don't stand up because it's bad. Her goal for this book was to help other survivors of sexual abuse, be they male or female, not just Maxwell and Epstein victims, anyone who has been coerced into having sex against their will with anyone at any point in their lives. And there are a lot of us out there, you know, most people have never told another soul, but a lot of people have had that experience. And her goal was to say to those people through this book, I see you, I am you. And I understand the shame that you feel that you shouldn't feel. And I understand how hard it is to move through the day sometimes, how hard it is to get up in the morning, because I'm going to show you how hard it is for me. Even now, even though I'm well known and I've won settlements, I want you to feel less alone. And if she ends the book this way, you know, if one person feels less alone, this book is a success. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is, you know, obviously we're doing a lot of interviews right now and a lot of the worst things that she experienced are being discussed for good reason, because they're abominable and we should all be angry about it. But this isn't just a catalog of horrors. It's not just a list of names. It's a portrait of an entire complex person. It's her highs and her lows. And you also see her coping and all of her different strategies that she had worked hard to have. In some ways, the biggest triumph for this person is that she is able to love again. that she's able to trust again, and that she had a family. She has three beautiful kids who she loved out of her mind. She loved listening to music, and there's a lot of music in the book. So you have, and she also knew this was going to be a very difficult reading experience. So there are times we turn directly to the reader and we say, hey, look, we know that this is a lot.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I needed to hear that quite early on in the book. There is a plea in Virginia's voice saying, you're probably feeling I've read enough now. I can't take it anymore. But please keep going. And I guess that's why it's so important, Amy, that you are doing such a great job of talking about this book. Can I just ask about your own feelings as to your own vulnerability? Are you concerned that clearly people wanted to put the frighteners on Virginia? Do you think people want you to shut up?
I'm sure there are people who would like me to shut up. I mean, I've taken precautions. Certainly, I'm keeping my eyes open. But the book is out there. You know, silencing me in whatever way that might happen won't silence it. Virginia's voice now lives on. And that is one of the real triumphs of the book. I'm proud to have been involved in it. I am honored to be speaking on her behalf. I wish she was talking to you right now. This is her triumph. I was her helpmate in getting it done. But it's important. And I guess what I would say is, victims out there, don't stop coming forward if you can. And I'm not going to be quiet. You're not going to be quiet. We all need to be talking about this. What's going on in our culture globally that treats women as less than. And that is alive and well. It didn't die with Epstein.
Amy Wallace, Nobody's Child by Virginia Giuffre is out today. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
You never forget the dogs you've loved. They have the power to steal our hearts, to love us unconditionally, and be there for us when we need them most without saying a word. You understand how a dog can change a life. A guide dog can transform the life of someone living with sight loss. Will you help change someone else's life with a gift in your will to guide dogs? Request our free will guide today. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
Guide dogs.
At Buy Association, we stay one step ahead of the property market, which is why our award-winning consultants know that Manchester has recently overtaken London as the UK's top hotspot for residential property. With an ever-expanding city centre, new transport links and a booming rental market, the smart money really is in Manchester. Discover why more and more people are choosing Manchester and request your free property guide today. Text BA Radio to 66777. Buy Association. Rated excellent on Trustpilot.
Stayshore. What is Stayshore? Stayshore is not just the UK's favourite travel insurance. Stayshore is the confidence that comes with knowing that you're covered by the company with more five-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other provider. A company that welcomes people of all ages with pre-existing medical conditions for single or multiple trips. So Stayshore with Stayshore Travel Insurance. UK's favourite relates to number of five-star Trustpilot reviews, T's and C's and verifications at stayshore.co.uk/reviews.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Thank you very much for your company this afternoon. That was before the ad break. That was, of course, Amy Wallace, who helped Virginia Giuffre write this harrowing but incredibly important book, Nobody's Girl. John Peanut is next. Thanks to Ryan and Felix. Have a very good evening.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Reports the King's aide was the head of royal protection when Prince Andrew allegedly asked one of his police officers to dig up dirt on his accuser, Virginia Giuffre. And a third abuse survivor has resigned from their role in the government's inquiry into grooming gangs. And coming up on Drive, as Britain ups its contribution to the 30-nation so-called coalition of the willing in support of Ukraine, what use is the grouping if it spends most of its time sat still? We're going to be looking at the next steps in bolstering Kyiv's position with Larissa Brown, Times Defence Editor, and I'll be talking to a former commander of Finland's Armoured Brigade. We'll get the latest from him from Westminster as MPs discuss what to do about Prince Andrew. And after the largest ever crackdown on shoplifting in the capital, can it be replicated countrywide?
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A third victim of sexual abuse has withdrawn from Britain's grooming gang inquiry amid claims the process was descending into chaos. The survivor, who hasn't publicly identified herself, has followed Fiona Goddard and Ellie-Anne Reynolds in resigning. One of two candidates shortlisted to run the inquiry has also pulled out. Fiona Goddard accused the Home Office of secretive conduct, including about the appointment of the investigation's chair. Ellie-Anne Reynolds claimed the scope's being widened to downplay racial motivations behind the abuse, something the government denies. Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philps says it's a disgrace.
The government has said nothing substantive publicly, and their inquiry is descending into chaos. What we have heard publicly is that victims and survivors on the liaison panel have no confidence in the government and no confidence in the inquiry.
The King's aide was apparently the head of royal protection when Prince Andrew allegedly asked one of his police officers to dig up dirt on his accuser, Virginia Giuffre. Lord Peter Roslin, who is now the personal secretary to the King and Queen, was in the role between 2003 and 2014. It's not clear if he knew about the alleged request. Meanwhile, the co-writer of Virginia Giuffre's posthumous memoir has told Times Radio she paid the ultimate price for telling her story. Nobody's Girl is officially released today, giving more details of Ms. Giuffre's allegations about Prince Andrew, which he has always denied. Award-winning reporter Amy Wallace was chosen to help write the book and told Jane Garvey how she felt when she heard Virginia had taken her own life.
Virginia was adamant that we talk about and acknowledge herself as a woman in full, her highs and her lows, and we acknowledge in the book that she had attempted to kill herself before. So on the one hand, I knew that she had this sort of wolf at the door, this voice in her head, which she described to me as saying, the world will be a better place without you in it. And readers of this book will understand when they see what she went through in her entire life, not just with Epstein, but in previous situations as well.
The former Chief Constable of Northamptonshire Police has been charged with fraud and misconduct in public office after allegedly lying about his military service. The Independent Office for Police Conduct said Nick Adderley is accused of making false claims of being a decorated Navy officer while applying to work for the force. The Crown Prosecution Service said Adderley is also alleged to have lied about his education achievements. He'll appear at Westminster Magistrates Court next month. Boris Johnson's told the COVID inquiry his government didn't fail to plan for coronavirus school closures. The former Prime Minister says the need for such preparations was obvious, but admits children paid a huge price to protect society. And the Governor of the Bank of England has warned that alarm bells are ringing over risky lending in the private credit markets. Follows the collapse of First Brands and Tricolour, and Andrew Bailey drew parallels with practices leading up to the financial crisis in 2008. Testifying before the House of Lords Financial Services Regulation Committee, he said we're starting to see what used to be called slicing and dicing and tranching of loan structures. And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. There's so much to get you up to speed with on today's programme as the pressure intensifies on Prince Andrew. I'll bring you the latest on that story. And on the global stage, major crisis and high stakes in play. The US Vice President J.D. Vance arrives in Israel to try to turn the fragile ceasefire in Gaza into progress towards peace. What are the chances? First, though, a remarkable call by one of the best-known names in world diplomacy, Kurt Volker, for Britain and other nations willing to help guard an eventual ceasefire to send troops into Ukraine now. The UK Defence Secretary, John Healey, yesterday pledged £100 million to fund Britain's contribution as part of that 30-nation so-called Coalition of the Willing. Critics are now mocking what they are calling the Coalition of the Waiting. Russia's Vladimir Putin has warned NATO forces that they'll be treated as a target if they deployed into Ukraine during a ceasefire. Does that amount, then, to a Russian veto on the plan? Well, no, says Kurt Volker. The former US ambassador to NATO and the United Nations says the coalition should go in now without waiting for a ceasefire, not to fight on the front line, but train Ukrainian forces to help guard the skies near the NATO border. But would that also expose British and other forces, friendly forces, to Russian attack? Would that mean war with Russia? As I say, it is a radical idea, and I'm going to be talking live to Kurt Volker later on in the programme, and in a moment, to the former commanding general of the Finnish Armoured Brigade. I wonder what you are thinking. Now, send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. So, the preparations for a bilateral meeting between Presidents Trump and Putin grind on. The blackouts, drone attacks, they continue across Ukraine. Four people died in Chernihiv today. President Zelensky and European leaders have said the current line of contact should be the starting point for negotiations. That's after Donald Trump reportedly pressured Ukraine to surrender the entire Donbass region. Now, for his part, John Healey, the Defence Secretary, said, as I say, that Britain will provide £100 million of funding for that coalition of the willing. But Trump's former envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker, he spoke to CNN and said Europe was not doing enough.
They could go ahead and deploy a coalition of the willing to Ukrainian territory for training, equipping, and assistance with air defense. Right now, jokingly, some people refer to this as a coalition of the waiting. They're still not doing it. They're just talking about it. It could be done now. A third thing is to work at NATO to integrate Ukrainian and NATO air defenses and extend NATO's air defense zone by 150 kilometers or so over western Ukraine together with Ukraine. This would make airspace safer for NATO countries because Russia's been violating them regularly, and it would also provide some assistance to Ukraine in protecting its civilian populations.
Well, as you can see, this is radical stuff, and I'm going to be talking to Ambassador Volker after 5 o'clock on this programme. Now, though, let's say a good afternoon. Hello to Larissa Brown, the Times Defence Editor. Hey, Larissa.
Hi, John.
It's great to have you here, Larissa. Can you just get us up to date with the state of planning for this coalition of the willing as of right now?
Well, John Healey said yesterday that should they be needed now, British troops will be ready to go into Ukraine. But exactly what they'll be doing is still unclear. The latest planning was largely around the idea of training Ukrainian forces rather than this idea we had a long time ago, sending 10,000 troops potentially to man key ports and various other infrastructure. And also the talks that have been ongoing in the last few weeks have been about also manning the skies, some air policing mission, and potentially having ships in the Black Sea. But of course, it keeps changing every day, and every